865 Brent Wilson v. State. We have Ms. Dickinson for the appellant, Ms. Morris for the respondent. Ms. Dickinson, you ready? No, no problem. No problem. Ms. Dickinson, you ready to proceed?
Yes, I
am. And did you want to reserve any time?
Yes, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes.
Okay, we'll take a look at the clock for you.
Okay. May it please the court, my name is Sharon Dickinson and I represent Brent Wilson. This court takes errors occurring during jury selection process very seriously. In Brass and Barrel, and in Buchanan, this court found structural error when the trial court did not follow the Nevada revised statute rules for selecting a jury, or did not follow the U.S. Constitution. In Brass, the trial court did not hold a Batson hearing at the time that the challenge was made. In Barrel, the trial court did not swear in the jury as required before voir dire. And in Buchanan, when the defendant challenged the veneer, the trial court waited until after the jury had rendered a verdict to hold a hearing on that challenge. Without calling it structural error, in Whitlock versus Solomon and Lenore versus Goodman, the court concluded that the constitutional guarantee of the right to counsel includes the right for counsel to directly question prospective jurors and reversed a conviction when the trial court prohibited any voir dire. Wilson contends constructional error occurred in this case. Trial court dismissed juror number 22 for bias without allowing any voir dire. This is structural error for several reasons. First, the court did not follow the rules in place for selecting the jury. NRS 175.031 allows voir dire. The trial court cannot unreasonably restrict voir dire. In this case, she did. She said none. She did not allow any. The court also violated NRS 176.036, which is the challenge for cause procedures. In this case, when they requested voir dire, it was because they wanted to question this juror further, because the defense was not sure that this woman was biased, and the court refused. The trial court also violated Wilson's right to due process and right to a fair and impartial jury. So what is structural error? Structural errors are the type that comprise the framework of the trial. Because a defendant has a Sixth Amendment right to a fair and impartial jury, errors that violate that right are structural without a showing of prejudice. Structural errors are not amenable to harmless error analysis. It's too difficult. There's no way to tell how serious the error is. So what happened in this case? The veneer came in. The court questioned the general veneer. And one question she asked was, is there anyone here who refuses to be open-minded, fair and impartial? Juror number 22 raises a hand and says, why do you believe you cannot honor that legal obligation? The juror goes into a rambling analysis, discussing the fact that her father was killed in all this. There was a situation or circumstance with the DA. She talks about here in trial for some persons, but apparently the case with her father didn't proceed. When she was on her way here, some man was being beaten, and talks about being sexually abused as a child. Court did not ask this juror one other question. And that's important because if you look at the record, the court asked follow-up questions of many other jurors, but not this one. Instead, what happened? The court took a break. The court had not finished the general questions, but took a break. And the question of juror 22 came up first by the state and said, we're going to challenge her. We think she is prejudiced against the district attorney's office. Our Wilson's attorneys said, no, we'd like to question. We'd like to have some voir dire. We don't believe she is biased. The court said, no. The court said, I'm convinced that she cannot be fair and impartial, and I'm going to excuse her for cause right now based upon the questions I asked, really one question, and granted the state's challenge for cause. So what's wrong here? This chair, number 22, would have been seated in the panel of 24, because the court said the procedure I'm using is the Arizona method. I'm going to go ahead and put 24 jurors in the box. You can question them and use your peremptory challenges. So this juror would have been seated there, but she did not get there because the judge removed her without voir dire being completed and without Wilson being able to challenge her for cause. So what procedure should the court have used? Well, the court does the general questioning under NRS 6.010 and NRS 6.030. It's just to see if the jurors qualify or if they have a hardship. That's what the initial questions are supposed to be about. Then the individual questions go into more voir dire about hardship. That is the way normal voir dire occurs. Under NRS 175.031, any supplemental examination must not be unreasonably restricted. In fact, in Salazar versus State, this court reversed a case when the trial court unreasonably restricted question.
In 175.031, though, prior to that last sentence, the examination by such further inquiry as the court deems proper. And then we segue over to 175.036.1, where it talks in terms of it's a may, not shall. So what's, from your standpoint, the interplay between those two statutes?
I think under 175.031, there can be no restriction on the general voir dire. That normally occurs before there's a challenge. When the challenge is made, it says may, it means that a party does not have to make a challenge. They can or they don't have to. But the second section says the challenges will be tried by the court, and the juror challenging any other person may be examined as a witness on the trial of the challenge. So the trial court here did not follow either of these statutes, just made up a decision upon just some brief questioning and removed this juror.
Could Ms. Dickinson, let's say for the sake of argument, we agree with you, and we haven't even discussed it. I mean, that's why we're here for oral argument. But was your client prejudiced in any way by the picking of the remainder of the jury? In other words, is there something else that happened in this trial where you feel that excusing this juror for cause somehow prejudiced your client with the remainder of the jury?
Well, under structural error, the defendant does not have to show prejudice. Now, the state argues...
Well, this isn't a Batson-type situation, is it?
No, but under structural error, we don't have to show prejudice. Like in the Barrow case, when the trial court did not swear in the jury, the court found...
Well, let's say for the sake of argument, we don't think it's structural error, and maybe we will when we're done, but is there any prejudice here with the remaining jury was selected in your point of view? How was Mr. Wilson harmed by the judge granting the cause challenge here on this particular juror number 22?
Okay. Mr. Wilson was harmed because there was a juror who has a right to be on the jury removed without due cause. Now, if you're asking me, well, what about all the other jurors? You know, there was no other challenges for cause made. But under structural error, which the court may or not agree, it's impossible to argue whether the error is harmless. And here it's impossible to do that because we have no record.
Well, you said this juror would have been seated under the Arizona method because where the juror was positioned in the jury box. So the juror that replaced this one, or however it moved up in the jury box, was some problem with the subsequent jurors then like that that you feel may have really impacted your client's right in this case?
Well, the state did not, defense did not challenge any other jurors for cause that were not removed. But what the effect of this is was to give actually the state an additional peremptory challenge. So in that sense, it was not fair. I'm not sure that there were any other errors that were magnified by this, except it would, obviously another juror would have not been on the jury.
Okay. My other question is, we have an arcade case that Justice Douglas authored called Preciado versus State. It was a case about 2 years ago that discussed the fact you have to record bench conferences, but another part of that opinion discussed this challenges for cause, and the court basically said that the judges should not restrict these challenges for cause. They should exercise them. They don't have to have this endless rehabilitation, and if they see a problem, they should strike a juror for cause. I'm just wondering how, if you're familiar with that case, and how you feel this impacts our decision in this one.
Well, the APA rules require challenges for cause to be held outside the jury so that the entire jury is not aware of what's going on. You know, and that creates a problem when it's happening in front of the jury. Here, there was just one question. And if the judge really felt this juror needs to be removed, she could have brought the juror in individually and exercised a challenge for cause. I understand what the court means about any back and forth, but there was no back and forth here because neither party got the question.
Did the record show that the defense attorney said, I want to traverse the challenge for cause?
She did.
Use the word traverse.
Well, she didn't use the word traverse. She says, I want to question her because I'm not sure that she's biased.
Did counsel ask for sidebar?
They did this hearing with the jury not there. The judge released the jurors, and they had a hearing about what had happened, not only with this juror, but with others.
You've got about 3:30, 3:30.
I just want to say quickly that even if the court believes there was structural error and should be reversed, there's certainly other reasons here to reverse this case. The evidence certainly was not sufficient, and there were problems with the admission of the price for the bags, which I addressed in issue 2 and 3. And we also had prosecutorial misconduct in rebuttal closing.
Why did the appellate division of the public defender's office use a fast track in this? This was fast track, right?
It was a fast track.
Why would you do fast track if there's other issues? That's difficult for us without the briefing.
Well, if the court would like supplemental briefing now, I certainly will do that. It was under the fast track system at the time, and it fit within the work parameters. So.
But the rule that I had established with our criminal division was that if you wanted full briefing, you were going to get it. And that's why I don't understand why you didn't ask for a full briefing in this case. If in fact there were substantial issues, as you say, other than the failure to traverse the challenge for cause.
I was able to raise all those issues in the fast tracks. Mm-hmm. If the court has any other questions about the other issues?
You still have 2.5 minutes.
Before I...
For about a few issues.
Yeah, you want to say...
For about a few.
Yeah, okay. And Ms. Morris?
May it please the court, my name is Chief Deputy District Attorney Lindsay Morris. I'll be representing the state. With regards to the first issue that defense counsel just raised, they're essentially asking this court to rule that it was structural error with regards to the removal of juror number 22 for cause. And I think it's important to hear exactly what that juror said as opposed to paraphrase it from juror number 22. There's been a couple of instances in my life. Most recently here, my father was killed in August, and when we went to the district attorney, they told us it was circumstantial evidence and that we would have to go on for years and years without any money. Even coming in here today for a case, about Michael Kors bags, when my father was killed and nothing was done, I do have an issue. And when this morning I was on my way here, I saw 3 men beating some man who was at the southwest corner of Charleston and Fort while people cheered him on and watched. And I'm a child that was sexually abused, and the offender got off because, again, we didn't have a good lawyer. We couldn't pay. So to be honest, my husband and I are packing up, and we're going inaudible in June. I don't believe in the system called the justice system. At this point in time, when ultimately, after that question, the state challenged, and it was my challenge for cause of that particular juror, I felt that at that point, we had reached a stage where she's told us, she's literally listed a litany of reasons why she couldn't be a fair and impartial juror. And defense claims that ultimately there was a violation of NRS 175031, and that's incorrect. And ultimately, in this particular case, as we discussed the statute previously, any supplemental examination shall not be unreasonably restricted, and ultimately, the other parties are entitled to that by such further inquiry as the court deems proper. This court in this particular case was Judge Scotty. It was ultimately a case from overflow he heard prior to him having a criminal calendar, so he was a civil judge at the time. He didn't deem any additional questioning proper.
Counsel, yes. In this analysis and as you're going through it, additional question, if the additional question was simply, I heard what you said, but in this case, are you willing to set this aside and be fair and impartial? Why would that have been, or something of that nature, been inappropriate or deemed unnecessary? The other side, theoretically, depending on how you interpret the statute, is given the ability to traverse, to ask a question, not just a one-sided process. You said, I think they should be excused for cause. Does the other side not have a reason to at least ask for just a basic question?
And I understand that, Your Honor, and it's been my experience in the totality of jury trials that I've been a part of, that follow-up question then becomes another forum for that juror to expound upon the issues that they have. And it wasn't one-sided in I got to question and the defense didn't get to question. It started out with the judge, so it was the impartial person in the room asking the question. And I think it's important, and the state quoted it in their response, was that what Judge Gotti said, I saw her demeanor, I heard the way she answered, I heard trembling in her voice, and beyond that, I heard what she actually said. So at that point in time, do I think that she, under NRS 175036, indicated that she could not be fair and impartial? Yes, I think that stops the inquiry, and I think you have to be very cognizant about further poisoning your jury pool when clearly this woman has personal involvement with the justice system. And quite frankly, I would argue that it would be something defense would want to challenge for cause as well, because her closing statement was, I don't believe in this, you know, this system we call a justice system, and my husband and I are leaving in June. So I don't believe there was any harm in not asking a further question and allowing her a further poison the jury.
Your statement there, you do not feel. Concern is, the court is supposed to be fair and impartial and allow access by both parties. That's the concern we have, where they were not permitted to traverse even a single question.
And did Your Honor have
a... Well, I'm just going to say, along with what Justice Douglas is saying, because we've all been there, and let me tell you how many times I challenged for cause as a defense attorney, and the state was able to say, but you can be fair. And the case was always affirmed on appeal, even though I said that it was a improper challenge for cause. I worry about unintended consequences of this. And I think it'd be to the benefit of, in fact, if we go along with what you're saying, I think it's a benefit to the whole defense bar. Because then the state would not be able to traverse. And if you don't let the other party traverse, you're really cutting off the rights of the state or the defense in that matter. So I think that what I would say is, just tell me that this is harmless. Why would it be harmless if it's not structured? Just tell me why this is harmless.
Sure, Your Honor. Well, I think the reason that it's harmless is discussed in the state's response. Ultimately, what we're looking at is, was there abuse of discretion? We give the courts broad discretion in terms of, because they are the ones, just like I previously stated what Judge Scotty said, they're the ones that are there, that are listening to the people discuss what's going on. We give them considerable deference. I think that I actually went through the transcript and tried to recall whether or not the state used all of their peremptory challenges, because ultimately the defense is claiming this is an additional peremptory challenge. I understand that argument. I wasn't able to find that in the record, whether or not ultimately all of them were used or all of them were waived, because my argument would be that if that were the case, the state would have exercised a peremptory challenge. Certainly it would be helpful if I could tell you whether or not we exercised all of them. I wasn't able to deduce that from the record, so that was I don't know why that's not part of the record, to be honest, so that's unfortunate. But I do believe that it was harmless, because I don't believe that it affected a due process right of the defendant. I don't believe that ultimately it drastically affected the jury's outcome. I understand I just caught myself. I'm saying I don't believe, and it doesn't matter what I believe. But the record reflects ultimately that it wouldn't have affected the outcome, that none of his due process rights were violated. Further on in their brief, they discuss cumulative error, right? Well, if there were all of these issues going on, if was the issue of guilt close? Was the quality and character of the evidence, was it not there? Were any of these items lacking such that this particular person that wasn't allowed on the jury, did that affect any due process rights of the defendant? And no, because the evidence was overwhelming of this individual's guilt. He was caught with 8 Michael Kors bags with Macy's price tags affixed to them inside of a bag as he left a Macy's store. 3 of those bags he was seen taking on camera. Ultimately, he admitted, I came to this store to steal bags to pay my rent. He was ultimately taken into custody. The state admitted, I know defense counsel briefly discussed the issue with regards to the pricing. You'll have to forgive me, this is my first time arguing, so I'm not sure how much emphasis you want me to place on all the different areas. Certainly, I think that's worth responding to, because I think the Stevens case is very important in that the court was well aware of it, the defense was well aware of it, and the state was well aware of it. And the state had 2 separate legs to stand on for the admission of that external apprehension report. First and foremost, I do believe that it falls within the business exception. I understand that defense counsel claimed that it ultimately was a document created in anticipation of litigation, and certainly I understand why that wouldn't be allowed, right? Because then we could just create all these documents and just bypass the hearsay rule and get them in for litigation. But the truth of the matter is that documents are created with regards to a retail store. Theft is built into any business's business model. And ultimately, in this particular case, they create these documents anytime there is a theft or a potential theft. So it's something certainly that falls within that requirement and was admissible for those reasons. In addition, this individual, Maribel Ponce, that testified, unlike what defense says in both of their pleadings, did have experience working with Michael Kors bags. She worked on the floor as a sales associate for 8 to 10 years of her 23 years working for Macy's. At that point in time, she had independent knowledge as a sales associate of Michael Kors bags. So she ultimately testified that never in her life has she experienced a Michael Kors bag be worth less than $100. Ultimately, there were 8 bags found on him. So even if under the lower amount, there would have been $800 worth of merchandise. Now, the external apprehension report, I think, also satisfied Stevens, where the court ultimately said, we can't have a security officer merely look at an item and say, I looked at an item and here's what the price was, because certainly that would violate the best evidence rule, as well as essentially he's just testifying to a hearsay document. I would further point out that in the state's reply, we pointed out that there have been cases where price tags, courts have taken judicial notice of the authenticity of price tags. And all that we're talking about in this external apprehension report is a scanning of price tags generating a report. It's analogous to a receipt, which is ultimately what Stephen said we would have wanted in that case, and that's why it was overturned. So I think certainly the state has very firm footing with regards to being distinguishable from Stevens for the value of the purse at issue. With regards further to the, did we prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt? I think that, as I indicated previously, the evidence was overwhelming. Certainly the judges will look at the evidence. Could a reasonable jury have found all the elements beyond a reasonable doubt, looking at the light most favorable to the state? I think that certainly the state met their burden with the previous mentions that I had made of the factual issues that came out during court.
Your comment in closing argument that you proved the case beyond a reasonable doubt, which the appellants take an issue with now, you feel that's not misconduct in any way and something you have
no, and then I read, thank you for that question, I read thoroughly what I had said, and I did make a misstatement where I said that Ms. Cook saw all of the bags being taken. That was unintentional, and in reviewing the record, I did say that. Now, I know that one of the common jury instructions given is, none of the statements made by counsel are evidence. You are to rely on your notes and what you observed. And that was just an honest misstatement on my part. What we did have, and what I would argue, is that by way of inferring, which you are allowed to do, which would be circumstantial evidence, is that ultimately he was seen taking 3 bags. He was caught with 8 bags, all of the same type, all with Macy's price tags. Furthermore, inside bags that were from vendors not located inside the Galleria Mall. He passed all points of sale, didn't attempt to pay, and then also admitted to coming there specifically to steal these bags to pay his rent. So I do believe that certainly we had met that burden. That wasn't any intentional misstatement. It was a misstatement of it. I don't believe that it would be, I believe that it would be harmless. And that brings me to the discussion of the prosecutorial misconduct, where ultimately this issue of who's insulting whose intelligence. Mr. Giordani stood up in his first closing and said, I'm not going to insult your intelligence and belabor this point. He used it sort of as a colloquialism. Ms. Murphy got up and then said, you know, I would say that ultimately it's not challenging, you know, it's not insulting your intelligence to analyze things further and things of that nature, made a proper argument based on his argument. And then I stood up in my rebuttal and sort of followed along those lines. It wasn't disparaging. It wasn't personal, such as the cases cited by the state where, you know, would you buy a used car from the defense attorney? It had nothing to do with that. It was certainly along the lines of argument of one, argument of another, then based upon that further argument. And I think also it was proper characterization of the not my pants, not my bag defense by the state, because ultimately the state felt that the defense was misstating the burden upon the state, because the burden that we have is beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not beyond every conceivable potential doubt that someone might hypothetically come up with in their mind. That was the argument that was defense was making, and that was the argument that the state was rebutting. So I do believe that none of the statements made by counsel in rebuttal would have been of such a dimension that they would require reversal. And I don't think they would further contribute to the cumulative error with regards to prejudicing the defendant. I do believe that they would be harmless if, in fact, the court found that they were prosecutorial misconduct to begin with. I think that addresses all the issues that I wanted to raise, unless your honors have any further questions.
Questions? No questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Dickinson, you have 2 minutes and, oh, let's see what you got. 2 minutes and 24 seconds.
Your Honor, our attorneys made the objection. You can read it. It's on page 162 through 63, where they asked to be able to question this particular juror. With regard to this juror, in comparison to other jurors, she was not the only one who had someone murdered and brought this up during the questioning process. William Henning, his daughter was murdered. There was discussion about that. Maria Retana, her niece and sister were married. There was discussion about that. So that's not a reason for the judge just all of a sudden say, okay, we're not going to have this juror on the panel. There was nothing she said or could have said that would have tainted the juror, because these were different questions that were being addressed. I think it's important to point out that a juror has a right to be on the jury, too. Not only the defendant having a right to have a certain jury that's selected in a random process. The rules state that when the court is deciding a challenge for cause, the court is supposed to look at the totality of the circumstances. And when you only ask one question and you only get one response, that certainly is not a very thorough examination of that juror to remove her for cause.
Well, it's certainly a lengthy response, though, that Ms. Moore's read from the record.
It was lengthy, that's true, and there were other lengthy ones, too. This was not the only juror. This was the only juror at that point, but the process had not finished. It was still, the judge was still asking questions. So I would submit the error is not harmless. I also want to point out, with regard to Issue 3 and whether or not the document was prepared in anticipation of litigation. In the brief, the state did not even address the cases that I cited regarding this was anticipation of litigation, so it should not be admitted. So I ask the court to consider that when you're making a decision about that document that was admitted for the price. I believe that at best the state could have only proven a misdemeanor, if that, in the sufficiency of the evidence. With regard to the prosecutor misconduct, the state did not even try to defend their Saturday Night Live comment disparaging the defense.
Thank you. Court, thanks both of you for your arguments and briefs in this matter, and I expected good argument from both of you, and I think we got it. This case was